Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be with such a group. I find where I work that not everyone is in full agreement with quite a few of my positions on matters of importance. I must say that I am not being persecuted or anything of that sort, but it is wonderful to be with this congenial group. We at least are in agreement on some basic postulates, which we use as basis for discourse. I think this morning that I am speaking a little more broadly than the program would suggest, and I appreciate the fact that my colleague here offered me the opportunity to speak first. It's not that I need more coffee or anything, but since I have 20 minutes, I think I might use the 20 minutes for the purpose for which it was designated. My title really says everything that I'm going to say. But since I have 20 minutes, I will elaborate to some extent. My title is Discrimination from Atom to Adam. Discrimination from Atom to Adam. Don't think about it too much now, please. Sociologist Mabel Elliott has described maturity as the decision to join the universe. St. Paul warned his fellow Christians that it is hard to kick against the pricks. And Wiggins has urged the caveat that we cannot refragate the irrefragable. Man has been bruised and bloodied through history and prehistory because he fights the universe. And history will continue to repeat itself if man continues his puny attacks on the grand system of which he is a part. This morning I have little that is new in the usual sense, but I hope that something I say will stimulate some thinking which may be new to some of you. I want to give a perspective to discrimination and in the process to recognize both man's part in the universe and his uniqueness. My basic thesis is that discrimination is our universe in action. I will try again on that one. My basic thesis is that discrimination is our universe in action. Since man is part of the universe, discrimination is man in action. This position does not deny man's free will or his responsibility for choices, but it does suggest some limitation on the range within which choices may be made. Like the rest of the universe, it is my position, man cannot choose whether or not to discriminate. We cannot communicate without an agreement on language, of course. And if I were a philosopher, I'd take the next 2 hours discussing the meaning of the word with you. I would prefer, however, since I'm not a philosopher, simply to state my usage or describe my usage of the word discrimination. For my purpose, I ask you to think of discrimination as differential response to events, whether internal or external in their origins, and including differential approach and withdrawal. The present question is not whether the word is good or bad, but whether it communicates. I hope that it does for this morning. Now, since I will refer to some of the sciences, I would like to insert here a proposition. As I see it for this purpose, scientists spend their time seeking patterns of discrimination in the universe. They do not produce them. Their discoveries of existing patterns of discrimination may become technology when these patterns are found useful. And these patterns work only when the conditions are ripe. If you doubt this, you might check your own color TV set when you're next in front of the boob tube. Now, with this description, the brief description of my intention, and with a great deal of modesty, I invite you to survey with me several aspects of the universe. This may take you back to the seventh grade, and some of us would like to start there again, believe me. Let us see if there is any basis for my original proposition. And since we all began as dust and will return to dust, we might begin with physics. And I would like to begin with the discrimination of a stone. The stone, of course, has no life. The stone is inert. But the stone rejects some liquids. It accepts other liquids and will mingle with still others. Stones do not respond eagerly to pure water, which I understand from scientists we have never found yet or been able to produce. But stones will interact with certain acids. Stones, in their discrimination, have no choices. They are so constructed that their nature is such that they do discriminate. Another small illustration, and I will lean on the illustrations, of course. I would like to awe you with my extensive knowledge of all of these sciences and great depth, but since my wife is in the group this morning, she would tell you what a liar I am, and I'd rather you found out for yourself. Let's look at the magnetic field for a moment. It is very selective. It chooses to respond to some metals. It refuses to notice other metals and may even reject some metals. Magnetic fields have no choice. They must act as they act. One of our more recent technological developments based on discrimination is our system of electronic communication, in which, as you know, they are somehow able to communicate a dozen or more messages on a single piece of wire. This is possible because both the messages and the wire discriminate among messages. We now can scramble and unscramble. The physicist did not invent this discrimination. The physicist found it in the universe and has established the proper conditions, not determined by the scientist, the proper conditions for the exercise of this discrimination. Photons, although they have no mass, we are told, are attracted by the sun. They are, however, not very friendly to mirrors, as you know. This is probably the homeliest of the several illustrations that I will use. This pattern has existed for a long time. The discriminating configuration existed before the theory of relativity was developed, but as a result of this theory, which was man's actions, of course, someone decided to look at the sun and watch the photons go around it, and found a remarkable attraction, as most of you can remember. Not from having gone around the sun, of course, but from having read about the matter. Our radio and television waves have been around. They have been discriminating. If the signals sent to you and me from our local television or radio stations were not discriminating, we would lose them. They might fall in love with any metal object on the way. Somehow they don't, at least most of the time, they don't accept these intervening opportunities. In terms of these very limited facts, I feel that there is some basis for the statement that the physical realm is discrimination in action. In the field of chemistry, we study and learn how to predict discriminations. Oxygen, we find, is very friendly, positively gregarious. Oxygen is even aggressive in its approach to certain objects that are external to the oxygen. Not everything, however, is attractive to oxygen, and we have discovered, as you already know, that we can protect ourselves from oxygen if we join the universe. That is to say, if we use stainless steel, our utensils will not be happy with oxygen and they will not rust, which of course is the process of oxygen in action. The entire science of chemistry is the search for atomic and molecular discriminations, both favorable and unfavorable. And strangely, I must insert this, strangely, in our schools and colleges, we find people who are teaching discrimination constantly, without being aware that that's what they were doing, perhaps, who at the same time are denigrating all discriminations as being evil, bad, reprehensible, sinful, and as we now know, illegal in many, many situations. Until a few years ago, chemists told us, I was told quite a few years ago, that among the various phenomena that chemists are concerned with, there were several gases which were antisocial. Helium, neon, argon, krypton, xenon, and radon were known as inert gases. And we learned this for many generations. These gases were so discriminating that they wouldn't combine with any other atoms. They were not outgoing. As I said, they were antisocial. But just a couple of years ago, chemists, just fooling around, discovered that these gases are not inert at all. It's simply that they're not easily turned on. Fluorine is very attractive to each of these gases in certain circumstances, and I think you can imagine the excitement in argon, helium, and others when someone finally brought them close to that which they had loved throughout eternity. We won't pause to worry about that now because we have other worries that I want to invite your attention to. The circumstances had to be right. No change had occurred in the discrimination of helium, neon, and the others. But this is almost human. You probably read the other day about the 88-year-old man, the Englishman, who married for the first time. He was a relative of argon. He had been searching for 88 years. Finally, he found what he was looking for, just as these inert gases suddenly became hyperactive in the right circumstances and in the presence of the right external stimulus. Now, very briefly, biological discrimination. This is probably the most complex, partly because it includes both the physical realm and the chemical realm, and is based on both of them. Living matter is made of the physical chemical components we have selectively, very selectively, reviewed. Life is sometimes distinguished from the non-living matter on the basis of sensitivity and on the basis of discrimination. However, I hope I have hinted strongly enough that discrimination does not begin with life, but exists in the components out of which life comes. We have certainly seen the differential response is characteristic in the non-living foundations of the universe as we know it. The plant world exists through discrimination, from the selective ingestion of food and water to its quiet and unobtrusive breeding. As a matter of fact, I think some of us humans could learn from the quiet and unobtrusive breeding of some of our plants. We have become inquiet and very obtrusive. We even insist that people take pictures of us as we are breeding. I don't mean that he does. I'm Plants survive only if they make the right discriminations. They do not survive if they fail to make discriminations. Animals are closer to home, although the closer they get to us, the more we reject any basis for closeness. But let's look at my favorite animal, and perhaps yours, the amoeba, a one-celled animal. A rather peculiar in many ways, partly because he's one cell, but this funny little fellow, as you remember, has a great deal of trouble with his figure. He doesn't know when he goes to bed how he's going to look the next morning. Partly, and I would say primarily, because he does discriminate. He embraces, and this is a very strange thing to me, he embraces his food. If he makes a mistake, he removes himself from the embrace of that which is to him non-food. But with all this embracing, he is a lousy lover. He will not even date the paramecium. As you know, when he gets so pent up that he can't stand it anymore, he simply breaks apart into two pieces and never really meets, so far as we know, what he might otherwise be looking for. He rejects as well as embraces, and he probably has the purest bloodlines that we know. Scientist James Danielli recently, and by the way, I picked this up from the current Newsweek, he just announced the creation of test tube life. He and his associates dissembled amoebas, then reassembled them in a kind of scrambled fashion. That is to say, he took a part from this amoeba and attached it to a part from another amoeba, and then the third part from still a third amoeba. I have reservations about this as the creation of life. Obviously, there was continuity of life in this situation. However, Danielli found that the components of the new creatures discriminated, and it went about like this. If the parts of amoebas in the new amoeba came from the same genetic strain, the new amoeba was likely to survive. But if the parts came from different strains, the survival of the new creature was doubtful. I would say they lost about 100%. I think two of these crossed strains survived, whereas about 100% of the identical strains did survive, and I believe they took a rest after their operation. But within about 2 weeks, I understand, they began also to multiply themselves. A solitary task, but if they don't complain, I don't think we should. To say it another way, the Smiths among the amoeba would die before they would mix with the Joneses. Apparently, there was a very cordial relationship between the Smiths and the Smiths, and between the Joneses and the Joneses. Again, these scientists discovered patterns of discrimination. They did not produce them. They found them in the universe in which they had lived, and the amoeba especially, very probably for some millions of years. Now, let's move to Adam. I remind you of the title, Discrimination from Atom to Adam. I think you'll be encouraged to know that we have already reached Adam. Adam dies without discrimination. Genetically programmed, and if you don't like that word, you might say created, for differential response, Adam is a bundle of systems, each system doing its own discriminating job. Man as a physical creature discriminates electronically. His chemical components continue to perform discriminatingly as they have been programmed to perform from the beginning. His biological systems do their thing unless there is some interference, either externally or internally. Most of Adam's discriminations are unconscious and uncontrollable, which might be a good thing for us descendants of Adam, because we have difficulty keeping a few things in mind for a few minutes. But if we had to consciously operate all of the systems which are in the human organism, we would not worry about dying. We would be fearful, rather, of staying alive. But man does have controls. He can, in some situations, voluntarily act or react. And just the other day, I learned that I have, as a descendant of Adam, I have such control that I can even, by thinking about it, increase my blood pressure. What I'm trying to figure out now is how I may, by thinking about it, reduce my blood pressure. It may be a one-track situation, one-directional situation. Adam can learn non-programmed discriminations. Other animals may do this too, but I suspect that we have the edge in controls. Now, how is Adam different? We have many answers to that question, and each of us has his own, as well as some that we share with others. But in regard to discrimination, I have this feeling. Adam is probably the only living thing who worries about discrimination. I suspect that man is the only animal who has meetings in Atlanta, Georgia, to discuss discrimination, and certainly the only creature who has guilt feelings about discrimination. Adam may be the only creature who consistently and continually tries to fight the universe. So he has to be, too often, the one who loses this fight. Discrimination from atom to atom. Thank you very much.